research symposium sessions, this one focusing on meeting the needs of dual language learner children. I've said before, and I'll say every chance I get, just how, to me, how wonderful it is to get the opportunity from my leadership at NAYC to be employed, but also to craft the research symposium every year to bring in some really powerful, wonderful speakers to share. Sometimes it's speakers that you may know or have seen or heard about, or I may know or have heard or seen about, and sometimes maybe not. So sometimes it's making new friends, sometimes it's me reacquainted. But I owe that capacity, as I said, to NAYC leadership and at a number of levels of support, not the least of which is the leadership and the good graces of our governing board, which several years ago put in place the Center for Applied Research, which I direct, and this being one of the tasks of it. So I'd like to introduce a member of our governing board, actually our recently elected president-elect.
This is my first official duty as president-elect, and I'm truly happy to be here with you this morning. My job is to talk to you just for a second about sponsorship, because I'm sure you all know what sponsors do for organizations like ours. You see sponsor logos, you see sponsors do.
Well, good morning, and I too was here around, I wasn't here right at 8 because I had a meeting, but I was here at 9, so I think I'm not as late as some of you. And Kyle said you're late, I don't know. You have to talk to him about that. But Carol, it was a beautiful introduction, and really all I want to say is at Pearson, we, and Pearson Clinical Assessments is the division I'm with, so we understand how important research is. We understand how important efficacy is. We understand that you want to have things that are valid and reliable and developmentally appropriate. Those are all the things that are near and dear to us. I am privileged to work for a company who thinks about education, and we think about educating and always learning from the time you're born until you die. And that's really what we do. We do it worldwide and globally. And as Carol said, the opportunity to be able to sponsor this research symposium was the perfect match for us, because what you do is so ultimately important, because every educator is important, but educators in early childhood, personally, I think are the most important, because you're going to get our children off to a good start, and anything and everything we can do to support you is what we want to do. So thank you for everything you do, and thank you, NAYC, for giving us the opportunity to sponsor this research symposium. So have a great rest of your day and a wonderful rest of the conference.
Thanks, Cheryl. Thanks so much. You know, one of the things we value in early childhood is relationships, and I think over the year, for better or for worse, one of the better part is we do have a very wonderful and equally serving relationship with Pearson. That's the good part. The better or worse part is over the years relationships develop, and one of the things that happens with a relationship is a level of trust occurs. And the worst part, I hope not, is that people who know me personally would say this is worse. I operate in this context with a tremendous level of trust from Pearson, where Cheryl says, about March-ish, I guess, these days. So Kyle, what does the research symposium look like this year? There's not even a light hand, there's no handedness in our relationship in terms of direction of what you should or should not get to. It's go out and find the people to speak to the needs. What are the needs that help? And really, it's because of the sponsorship for Pearson that I'm able to act on that and not go on, as we oftentimes have to do, a few folks organize professional development for programs, you have to go on who's local, right? Or who you can get to come for low cost, you can come for volunteer. But with some support from a sponsor, we can look nationally and internationally and say, who are the national people for that we want to bring in and speak. And so that brings us to today's session on dual language learners and just how remarkable in it. So I want to say just a couple of things, and then I'm going to get out of the way, because that's what I do best, is I know when to get out of the way. Karen Nemeth, who's one of our speakers, who folks know Karen. Karen's one of those very quiet, demure. we're actually going to turn the microphone off when she starts. Speakers. I never met Karen. I've read Karen's work for a lot of time. And she kind of made the mistake of calling me about something else when I was putting the symposium together. And remember this, Karen? And as we were finishing up, I said, oh, and by the way, you know the Institute is going to be in San Francisco this year, and I want to do a panel on dual language learners. And you are one of the people that's on top of my list of someone who's out here in the world working in programs and in writing about meeting the needs of dual language learner. So a very Machiavellian, I just did you a favor, would you consider putting a hold on a calendar slot? And Karen's lovely, wonderful, and of course she did. And so one of our first speaker I am very excited about is Karen Nemeth. Marlene Zapeda, which I hope I'm coming close with that name, is a name that I knew much, much, much far in advance of the person. I actually met Marlene for the first time on Friday, a pre-meeting to this institute. I've been here like forever. I'm going to vote in this fall's election, I think. And why Marlene was on top of that list is a little report she's going to talk about building competencies among teachers to support dual language learners. And one of the things that I say oftentimes as a researcher doing research to practice and policy, just my observation, is that teachers need to build competence, knowledge, and confidence. Okay, confidence and confidence to be successful. And we can affect the confidence, we can affect knowledge build up, and we can affect confidence by acknowledging expertise amongst our teacher core. So one of the things that I talk about, and I'm going to get out of this in a second, with the work that I do is research and practice. It's not the researchers talk to the practitioners, say you should do this. It's research, well at least the way I do it, is we need to also listen to people that are doing the work every day. And one, it's because it tells us what we need to do. But also, there's a tremendous validation and recognition that folks that are working in the field, many folks in this room are here because you're working with dual language learners. You guys have expertise that will far outstrip the expertise of someone who's published a research paper on dual language learner, hands down. And so that's why we shape these sessions the way that we do. And that's why I was really just tremendously excited when I kind of shyly did a cold email to Marlene, and I'm not necessarily shy in this regard, and she also accepted my invitation to be part of this panel. So I'm just really excited to be able to have these folks on the same stage together. I think they've done a couple of these dual things before, so they might do some dancing or something special. I don't know. And I think Karen, you're going first. So it's my pleasure to introduce both of them at this moment, but also to introduce the first speaker, Karen Nemeth. So Karen, it's on to you. Thank you.
Good morning. I would just like to assure you there will be no dancing.
Oh, shucks!
I'm so happy to be here to share about 5 hours worth of information with you in about 40 minutes. And but we're really sort of laying the foundations this morning. And after lunch, there's an important panel presentation by Linda Espinosa, Jean Garcia, and Dina Castro about their new research report that will fill in the gaps of what we're introducing to you this morning. And then I have a practice session this afternoon for adapting your professional development based on everything we talked about all day today. So if you just stick with us, by the end of the day, you'll know everything. So that's the point. We're not trying to cover everything this morning. We have a particular focus, and my focus, this is my NACI book, The Basics of Teaching Dual Language Learners, and, an example of one of my other books, where I work with the researchers to bring that information down into a form that is practical and useful day-to-day for the teachers. And those tools that I use to give those pieces of information to the teachers, those tools are what I want to give to you today. And one of those tools is the March
2013 issue of Young Children, which was the cluster issue about supporting dual language learners. Thank you, NAEYC, right? And so some of those articles are available online if you're not one of the ones that gets the copy. So now I'm just going to answer this little question. Who are those DLLs? We're all talking about them all the time. First of all, any child who speaks a language at home or is learning a language at home other than English is considered a dual language learner, regardless of their proficiency in either language. That's important. And according to that definition, we're saying that about 25% of the population of children under 6 in the United States are dual language learners. Now, if I'm going to tell you that a quarter of all of the children under age 6 in our country are in this category, which one of you could afford not to address that one quarter of the population in the training, coursework, and professional development that you provide for our teachers? We all have to be thinking about this. We also know that children under 6 who are dual language learners are the fastest growing segment in our population. So while we speak, my number should be going up. I should have one of those tickers on my screen. Children under 6, the fastest growing population. Of children under 6, the children who come from immigrant families are the fastest growing segment of young children, and the young children are the fastest growing segment of the immigrant population. So, well, any way you look at it, this is not something that's going to level off or shrink. Everyone in this room needs to become an expert on how we support children who come from different language backgrounds. We also say that about 25% of the children who are dual language learners live in families where no adult speaks fluent English. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about that today. We know that dual language learners may speak English very well. That doesn't mean they know everything in their brain in English. They learn some things in their home language and some things in their English language as they're learning, but we need to depend on all of their knowledge in order to help them grow. They may be born in the U.S. or they may not be born in the U.S. And so we have a couple of specifics that are going to help us cover this. Now, look at this. Office of Head Start helped us out by creating the definition for what it means to be a dual language learner. You could either be simultaneously learning two languages, like you have one parent who speaks one language and one parent who speaks the other, or it could be sequential, where you started out in one language and then you came to a new country, a new neighborhood, or a new school where you're learning a new language. But in any of those cases, they're all dual language learners, even if they seem to speak English pretty well. This is critical. Okay, and we're trying to look at the terminology there. We like to use the term dual language learners for preschoolers now because the big kids school term is what, who knows what we say in elementary school? ELLs, right? English language learners, as if your goal in life is to set children on a path marching away from their home language and immersing themselves in English. And that is clearly not where the research wants that path to go. We need to support both of those languages, which you're going to be hearing about throughout today, this morning, the afternoon session, etc. And supporting that home language is the key to changing how we prepare our teacher ed majors and our future teachers and our current teachers to deal with these children. Okay, another thing that you need to know is this. Is there a little bit of a difference in the level of poverty experienced by children from immigrant families? Children who are dual language learners are much more likely to live in conditions of poverty than children who are English only. So, in addition to our considerations about their language development, we need our new teachers and our current teachers to be really aware of the complexity of the developmental issues that these children bring to our table and to really help them and support them in that. But that's okay because this afternoon you're going to see this. The dual language learners research informing policy paper, which is the session after lunch, that was written by Dean Castro, Jean Garcia, and Amy Marcos, and the panel will be presenting some of the details that will really help you pin down exactly what information about that stuff that you want to bring back to your program. But we have a particular question today, and it's kind of prickly, see that? See how I picked that graphic? Prickly. Okay. Preparing, how are we, not they, not you, not somebody, how are we, every single one of us, going to take a look at what we're doing and the work we do with the current and future early childhood educators, and how are we going to help them work successfully with dual language learners? Okay? Because, and this is a direct quote from Karen Nemeth. I actually believe, based on the numbers, based on that 25% number and the fastest growing segment of the population figures that we keep talking about, I believe that almost every teacher who is going to work with children ages 0 to 5 is going to, at some point in their career, probably sooner more than later, going to be working with children who don't speak the same language they do. And we have got to get on the ball. Teachers are facing increasing diversity, but wait, there's more. They are also facing multiple languages in the same classrooms. How many times do I work with teachers who tell me they have 6 and 8 languages in the same classroom? And by golly, they spend the whole year trying to get their act together to support those kids. And then next year, 6 or 8 different languages show up and they've got to start all over again. What are you doing every day to help them with that sticky problem, right? We also have multiple cultural influences. You can buy a lot of books in English and Spanish, but does that help them understand the different places that Spanish-speaking families come from, the different cultures within each of those places that those children come from? We're having changing mix of language, and here's a big one. Look at this sticky problem at the bottom. See how you're all nodding, right? Mm-hmm. State and local regulations that don't necessarily match up with what the fancy-schmancy researchers are telling you over here at the Macy now. I wrote this article for the Colorín Colorado website, and which is linked on your handout, but I know not everybody got your handout because I didn't realize I was a rock star until I got here, you know. But you will get my email address at the end. I showed it at the beginning, and you'd probably rather have the resource list by email or getting it off the NACI website anyway, because then you'll have live links. But anyway, so I wrote this bit about state policies on dual language learners in early childhood education. It gave me a big headache to write them. But, you know, we've talked a lot about what's happening in Illinois, and it's a story. It's been in the news, and it's the story in which transitional bilingual education comes to preschool. And so if you could just memorize the Illinois Bilingual Education Code, you will see.
Yes.
If the preschool program of an attendance center or a non-school-based facility has 19 or fewer students of limited English proficiency, classification other than English, and the school district shall meet the requirements of subsections of this section of their... The basic idea is they're supposed to provide bilingual education even for preschool children who are determined to be limited English proficient. But Illinois is not the only one. Look what New Jersey has in their code. All district boards of education shall also provide appropriate instructional programs to eligible preschool limited English proficient students based on need according to New Jersey preschool teaching and learning expectations. So in New Jersey, what they say is you need to provide support for those students, but you need to provide it in a way that's specifically developmentally appropriate for preschool. And so there's at least one person I know who's sitting in this audience right now that's saying, oh really, Karen? Why aren't they talking about infants and toddlers? And you'll notice that in the state codes, they you know, basically are happy to relinquish control of those babies. But in this room, we don't. We have to think, what does this mean to the teachers we work with who are in those programs or working with infants and toddlers? Okay, so here's what I want to ask them. Limited English proficient? 3 and 4-year-olds?
Yeah, I know.
What? It's another reason why we're really trying to use that term dual language learners, that they're learning, they're in the process of learning, they haven't finished one language and left it behind and moved on. They're not finished with anything. And we need to really help all of our teachers understand that it's not a question of reaching a plateau and stopping, that this process of developing first language and second language is ongoing and continuing to need support. So what is it that we should be imparting to teachers? One of the things that Castro, Garcia, and Marcos report tells us is that dual language learners have 2 separate language systems from the time they begin exposure to those languages, and that can happen before birth. I mean, they develop those 2 systems beginning before birth and show evidence of it upon birth, and that this is not harmful to them. We know that the brain has the ability to catalog speech sounds in 2 languages, right from birth or possibly from before birth. That the brain is prepared to learn in more than one language, and that preparation exists regardless of the child's cognitive ability or developmental level. And in fact, the Division of Early Childhood of Council for Exceptional Children has a position statement in which they clearly say that all children, regardless of their ability or disability, has the right to learn and have support of their home language. We also understand that infants develop the first language, and we need teachers to really capture that understanding, how the brain learns the first language, to inform their understanding of how the brain works on the second language. So even if they don't work with babies, they need to understand how the baby brain works in terms of language development, because that is a key to everything they do to meet their dual language learner needs of their kid. And so to prove that, I'm going to show you a movie. You believe me, don't you?
Maybe.
Yeah, I know. It's questionable. And if there's anyone that could douse the light, that would be good, but not necessary. Just be an advantage.
I want you to take a look at this baby. What you're drawn to are her eyes and the skin you love to touch. But today I'm going to talk to you about something you can't see. What's going on up in that little brain of hers? The modern tools of neuroscience are demonstrating to us that what's going on up there is nothing short of rocket science. And what we're learning is going to shed some light on what the romantic writers and poets describe as the celestial openness of the child's mind. What we see here is a mother in India, and she's speaking Koro, which is a newly discovered language. And she's talking to her baby. What this mother and the 800 people who speak Koro in the world understand that it, to preserve this language, they need to speak it to babies. And therein lies a critical puzzle. Why is it that you can't preserve a language by speaking to you and I, to the adults? Well, it's got to do with your brain. What we see here is that language has a critical period for learning. The way to read this slide is to look at your age on the horizontal axis. And you'll see on the vertical your skill at acquiring a second language. The babies and children are geniuses until they turn 7, and then there's a systematic decline. After puberty, we fall off the map. No scientists dispute this curve, but laboratories all over the world are trying to figure out why it works this way. Work in my lab is focused on the first critical period in development, and that is the period in which babies try to master which sounds are used in their language. We think by studying how the sounds are learned, we'll have a model for the rest of language, and perhaps for critical periods that may exist in childhood for social, emotional, and cognitive development. So we've been studying the babies using a technique that we're using all over the world in the sounds of all languages. The baby sits on a parent's lap, and we train them to turn their heads when a sound changes, like from ah to e. If they do so at the appropriate time, the black box lights up, and a panda bear pounds a drum. A six-monther adores the task. What have we learned? Well, babies all over the world are what I like to describe as citizens of the world. They can discriminate all the sounds of all languages, no matter what country we're testing and what language we're using. And that's remarkable because you and I can't do that. We're culture-bound listeners. We can discriminate the sounds of our own language, but not those of foreign languages. So the question arises, when do those citizens of the world turn into the language-bound listeners that we are? And the answer, before their first birthdays. What you see here is performance on that head turn task for babies tested in Tokyo and in the United States, here in Seattle, as they listen to Ra and La, sounds important to English but not to Japanese. So at 6 to 8 months, the babies are totally equivalent. 2 months later, something incredible occurs. The babies in the United States are getting a lot better. Babies in Japan are getting a lot worse, but both of those groups of babies are preparing for exactly the language that they're going to learn. So the question is, what's happening during this critical 2 month period? This is the critical period for sound development, but what's going on up there? So there are two things going on. The first is that the babies are listening intently to us, and they're taking statistics as they listen to us talk. They're taking statistics. So listen to two mothers speaking motherese, the universal language we use when we talk to kids, first in English and then in Japanese.
Ah, I love your big blue eyes. So pretty and nice.
Wow, 大きな茶色いお目目。そして綺麗な Kuroekami?
During the production of speech, when babies listen, what they're doing is taking statistics on the language that they hear. And those distributions grow. And what we've learned is that babies are sensitive to the statistics, and the statistics of Japanese and English are very, very different. English has a lot of R's and L's, the distribution shows. And the distribution of Japanese is totally different, where we see a group of intermediate sounds, which is known as the Japanese R. So babies absorb the statistics of the language, and it changes their brains. It changes them from the citizens of the world to the culture-bound listeners that we are. But we as adults are no longer absorbing those statistics. We're governed by the representations in memory that were formed early in development. So what we're seeing here is changing our models of what the critical period is about. We're arguing from a mathematical standpoint that the learning of language material may slow down when our distributions stabilize. It's raising lots of questions about bilingual people. Bilinguals must keep two sets of statistics in mind at once and flip between them, one after the other, depending on who they're speaking to. So we asked ourselves, can the babies take statistics on a brand new language? And we tested this by exposing American babies who'd never heard a second language to Mandarin for the first time during the critical period. We knew that when monolinguals were tested in Taipei and Seattle on the Mandarin sounds, they showed the same pattern. 6-8 months, they're totally equivalent. 2 months later, something incredible happens. But the Taiwanese babies are getting better, not the American babies. What we did was expose American babies during this period to Mandarin. It was like having Mandarin relatives come and visit for a month and move into your house and talk to the babies for 12 sessions. Here's what it looked like in the laboratory.
绿色的圈圈，绿色的圈圈，等一下，转一圈，嘿，一圈，再一次哦，转一圈，二，三。So what have we done to their little brains? We had to run a control group to make sure that just coming into the laboratory didn't improve your Mandarin skills. So a group of babies came in and listened to English, and we can see from the graph that exposure to English didn't improve their Mandarin. But look what happened to the babies exposed to Mandarin for 12 sessions. They were as good as the babies in Taiwan who'd been listening for 10 and a half months. What it demonstrated is that babies take statistics on a new language. Whatever you put in front of them, they'll take statistics on. But we wondered what role the human being played in this learning exercise. So we ran another group of babies in which the kids were get the same dosage, the same 12 sessions, but over a television set. And another group of babies who had just audio exposure and looked at a teddy bear on the screen. What did we do to their brains? What you see here is the audio result, no learning whatsoever, and the video result, no learning whatsoever. It takes a human being for babies to take their statistics. The social brain is controlling when the babies are taking their statistics. We want to get inside the brain and see this thing happening as babies are in front of televisions as opposed to in front of human beings. Thankfully, we have a new machine, magnetoencephalography, that allows us to do this. It looks like a hairdryer from Mars, but it's completely safe, completely non-invasive, and silent. We're looking at millimeter accuracy with regard to spatial and millisecond accuracy. Using 306 squids, these are superconducting quantum interference devices, to pick up the magnetic fields that change as we do our thinking. We're the first in the world to record babies in an MEG machine while they are learning. So this is little Emma. She's a 6-monther, and she's listening to various languages in the earphones that are in her ears. You can see she can move around. We're tracking her head with little pellets in a cap, so she's free to move, completely unconstrained. It's a technical tour de force. What are we seeing? We're seeing the baby brain as the baby hears a word in her language. The auditory areas light up, and then subsequently areas surrounding it that we think are related to coherence, getting the brain coordinated with its different areas, and causality, one brain area causing another to activate. We are embarking on a grand and golden age of knowledge about the child's brain development. We're going to be able to see a child's brain as they experience an emotion, as they learn to speak and read, as they solve a math problem, as they have an idea. And we're going to be able to invent brain-based interventions for children who have difficulty learning. Just as the poets and writers described, we're going to be able to see, I think, that wondrous openness, utter and complete openness of the mind of a child. In investigating the child's brain, we're going to uncover deep truths about what it means to be human. And in the process, we may be able to help keep our own minds open to learning for our entire lives. Thank you.
Okay, did that make an impression? Did you think you could use that with your students and the teachers that you work with to really make that impression? You can look that up online. It's a TED talk, and the title of it is The Linguistic Genius of Babies. That's Patricia Kuhl from the University of Washington. But you can use that in your programs. And here is the critical reason why looking at all those babies is important, whether you work with infant toddler caregivers, or families, or preschool teachers, or academic programs. Did you see anything in there that looked like effective use of flashcards? Do we work with the infant brain by presenting each alphabet letter once a week in sequence, regardless of what anyone's interested in? Right? This is why we need all early childhood teachers to see this video and to understand how the brain is prepared to learn language is not often connected to the way we think we should teach it. And we've got to really get back to the notion that it's a social and communication function that needs to be highlighted, and that relationship between the teacher and the child, whether it's a six-month-old baby or a five-year-old getting ready to go to kindergarten. It's that interaction, that human responsiveness that makes the difference in how well they do in their home language and in English. So we have to remember these stages. And again, preschool teachers are like, what do I have to know that for? You have to know this because, well, the first stage is crying. They do that, you know, that's their sole communication for 6 weeks, but you know how that is, right? Wah, 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 maybe they're hungry. Wah, wah, maybe they're tired. Wah, wah, maybe they have a pin sticking in them 3 inches, right? But we don't know. It all sounds the same. It's just crying. We have no idea what that baby needs. Is that true? Why not? They have different crying. And what else? The look on their face, their entire body communicates. The brain is prepared from birth to use an entire system to support communication. But we go to school and we forget to use what the brain is prepared to do to communicate. And for those children who speak different languages, that is the most important aspect of our communication. Understanding the baby brain will help you with that. But we go from crying to cooing to babbling that first year, which, as you know, happens like clockwork on the first birthday. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
In that first year, how much is being learned about language? Before anyone ever says a word. And all that stuff that has to do with the building of language and understanding and taking those statistics and interacting and getting your meaning known before you can use words, are we supporting that same level of development in our dual language learners? We know that growing up with those two languages brings a lot of benefits. It can support metalinguistic awareness, cognitive flexibility, enhanced working memory, executive functions. We've even seen a couple of studies reported in the New York Times that said people who grow up bilingual are less likely to have Alzheimer's disease. So if you can remember that, you could use that to your advantage. There are a lot of reasons beyond just, you know, researchers saying so, why it would be good for all of us to become bilingual. Understanding how that second language develops is important whether you're working with babies or preschoolers or whether it's about us. So this is the system that we use to describe the development of a second language, regardless of the age of the child. You know, they often come into the program beginning with just using the home language and wondering why you're not smart enough to understand them. And that can be true whether they're infants and toddlers, and this breaks my heart. The toddlers who are babbling and approximating sounds in their home language, but it sounds like gibberish to the caregiver, and they get no response, when actually they may be very accurately approximating words in their home language. So we really want to pay attention to these things all the way from the youngest all the way up. They may go through a silent period, but we always have to be careful of that. The silent period sort of reflects on that first year of the first language development when we're doing so much observing. Okay, but children at that time may also be experiencing stress or hearing loss or other reasons why they're silent. So we want to investigate all possibilities. When they start talking, they're not babies anymore. And we hear them often using formulaic or telegraphic speech. So you might hear the child that says, "I want that," as a formula. They don't know what "I" means or "want" or "that," but they know that they can say that utterance, "I want that," and something will happen. And then over time, as they use more, express more, and observe more, their language fluency develops, and they are in that sort of early productive informal fluency period, which we also lovingly call playground language. And during that time, those children can tell you whole kinds of wonderful stories in their new language. But have you noticed, those of you that have been in the classrooms with dual language learners, even at the time when they're doing really well in English and they're speaking a lot in their home language, they may know something in both of their languages, but if you ask them to translate, they can't do it. Have you noticed that? That's a grown-up thing to do. It's almost like preschool kids don't understand that question. They're either going to think about it and know about it and talk about it in one language or the other. So that's why they may look good in English, but a lot of the things they know are not in the English side yet, and they're in the home language side until they get to that full advanced fluency, academic fluency stage, which most researchers are saying takes about 5 to 7 years. 5 to 7 years. So I always ask my preschool teachers and infant toddler teachers, how many people in your four-year-old class have been alive for 5 to 7 years? And so that's another indicator that we need to continue supporting that home language. There's really not a time when they're with our preschool, infant, toddler, kindergarten teachers, they're really not a time when they're really ready to let go of support of their home language. So the research and the practice report also tells us that the features of a high-quality early childhood program, like intentional teaching, integrated learning, etc., are great for those kids, but they are not sufficient. And here's another finding that you'd hear about if you go to that presentation this afternoon. It's all about supporting that home language and helping teachers know how to do that. So here's one example of a research study that talks about how teachers can do that. Talking about how to use the vocabulary in the language they're stronger in to help them understand words in their new language. And that could go both ways. Explaining words in the both languages as we're about to read a book and so forth. So we have a few studies that are actually giving us specific examples of strategies that teachers can use so that they can interact with those children with more confidence. But we also get studies like this. Now, I'll just ask you to bear with me and read this for a second. This is a quote from a report that David Dickinson did on a study with Michelle Porsche. Just read this for a second, and then I'm going to ask you a question about it. Isn't that compelling? All that conversation can make such a huge difference. And now here's my question. If you got kids in your classroom who don't understand a word you say, how are you going to make that happen? How are you going to make that advantage happen for those children? So on the one hand, we have studies that actually refer directly to our how to work with dual language learners. On the other hand, you have to be truly aware of studies that come out that talk about early language development, early literacy skills, and always ask yourself that question. Oh, really? How can my teachers actually use this in a diverse classroom? And you're going to need to be prepared to make those adaptations, but that's okay. Marlene's going to tell you all. And so here's a study that actually examined the content in early childhood education teacher preparation programs, and it did find 43% of programs do require a full course on working with children and families from diverse cultural linguistic backgrounds. Of course, they were focusing on New Jersey, and New Jersey didn't quite measure up, but that's okay. They're working on it. Actually, things are changing in New Jersey, and that's important. But one important thing you have to remember is that in colleges where you have early childhood education and you also have ESL training programs, they usually don't talk to each other. And most teachers who are majoring in ESL or getting a degree in ESL have never had a single course that addresses the learning needs of children under the age of 5. But yet they know things that you could use, and you early childhood people should be storming their doors and giving them the information that you know about what those young children need so that everybody can work together and prepare those teachers in the way they need to be prepared. Because this is what we're looking for. Right? We're looking for children just to be able to talk to each other and enjoy each other and grow up together, and all of us sharing the advantages of those different languages and the wealth of assets that brings for us. But in order to make it look like this, instead of two children with their backs to each other, in order for it to, every early childhood program that deals with children from birth on up to really be effective now, every teacher you prepare needs to know how language develops the first time, how second language develops, and specifically, what does the research recommend in terms of how to adapt teaching practices to work with all of those children? You know, we're talking a lot in this country right now about the new initiatives for pre-K for all. And if you follow those initiatives, you'll see comments by me every Twitter feed, blog, LinkedIn post, Facebook post, where I keep asking that question. If we're really talking about pre-K for all, we've got to talk about pre-K for all languages, for all cultures, for every child, not just the easy ones. And so that's what I hope to bring to you today. Now I'm going to open it up for questions or comments before I hand it over to Marlene, who's going to give you some really powerful research that you can use and bring back. So this is their sort of general opening. Any questions? Yeah.
In your initial slide talking about first and second languages, is that information also true for a child who actually has three home languages?
Yes.
Thank you.
And many times they do. Yeah.
I know that your books have great practical strategies. One of my things, I mean, I understand about Spanish, mm-hmm. but like I don't know Urdu, and to understand about, you know, how I can be responsive. You know, you talk about the 8 different languages, mm-hmm. and being able to help the child transfer skills from one language system to another. So do you have any recommendations on how we can become, not experts, but at least being able to facilitate that transfer of skills?
Yes, I do. I think you should ask Marlene Zepeda. No. And actually, technically, you should ask her. But in addition to that, the number one answer to that question, everybody should have their pen down. Your secret weapon is the parents. You might not speak Urdu, but that kid's parents do. So if you want that child to have rich, engaging literacy experiences and conversations and interactions in their home language, all you have to do is prepare the parents to provide that. And that really is an important and useful strategy that's often overlooked. We're so busy, you know, trying to account for every minute in the classroom and giving up if it's a language that we don't know and we're not comfortable with, or a language we have trouble finding materials. But the secret answer is working with those parents, but preparing them appropriately with those skills. Don't just send books home, but help them understand what to do with those books. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're thinking in your mind, and I detect that you're saying, but many programs also hire bilingual assistants in their classrooms. And I will tell you, how many of you work with programs that you know hire bilingual assistants in order to support those language needs, right? That's a pretty common strategy. And now I'm going to ask you this question. How many of you know that those programs provide explicit training for those bilingual assistants about exactly what they should do with their languages, exactly how they should use their home language and how much they should use English? Raise your hand if your program has a guidebook or a training orientation for those bilingual aides. Look around the room. Like a third of the people said they have them, and nobody is preparing them. But you got it here. You can use this information. We need not only that you're bilingual, but that you know what you're doing with that language. And that's what you're going to get today. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
Will your PowerPoint be online for?
Yes. That's the answer when you go back after the conference, when you look up all of the different workshops that you attended, where you click now and you can see the description. Later when we post them, you click on that same description and it'll have the links to the PowerPoints, handouts, all that kind of stuff. On any, even the ones you missed, you can still get there. So I think that's a great resource NAC provides. Someone in the back had a question. In the back one, yes. And have any of you encountered that problem that parents are not literate in their home language? Yes, serious problem, but they're real good talkers, and they love their babies. So how about getting collections of wordless books and then helping parents, bringing them in to help them understand how to tell stories and sing songs and helping them understand the value of person-to-person, you know, parent-to-child conversations really can make a huge difference. But we need to recognize it's not all about reading books. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you say to parents of infant toddlers who are English language learners or and perceive the child as a language learner?
Okay, we say two things. That's an excellent question. One thing we say is, if it seems that the child has an actual language delay in both languages, it is a sign that they might actually be experiencing a true language delay or developmental disability. And we want to really assess for that and be watchful for that. More so if a child is expressing, you know, what is perceived as trouble in one language, but they're fine in the other language, and it's likely they don't have a disability. But it goes like this. In my classroom, I have a toddler who can identify blue and yellow. And I think, oh, he really should know more colors. But my assistant tells me that child can identify rojo y verde. Oh, that child can only identify two colors. That's only two colors. But really, that's not a two-color baby, is it? That's a four-color baby. So most often, the perceived deficit is because we, the grown-ups, are not smart enough to assess across those languages and combine those assets to understand only two colors in one and only two colors in the other language. That's not a weakness. It's an observational weakness. That's a child who has an asset of four colors, which is on target, and we need to combine that knowledge. Because he knows rojo does not mean he knows red. And just because he knows blue does not mean he knows azul. And we need to, so that's the answer. Assessing across both those languages and not isolating the two separate, but looking at the total, which in most cases means they're smarter than us. So, yeah. Okay, other questions? Okay, I'm going to unplug and let Marlene get plugged in here. So this is your chance to say howdy do to your neighbor while we just unplug one thing and the other, and then you'll be surprised how fast we get back on track.
Excuse me.
Oh.
Really?
So I didn't even dance.
If you go to the TED Talk,
so all we're doing is switch over to a multilingual, multicultural program, right? Rather than a deficit program. I only had one smart thing to say.
No, so.
All right. Let's see if I can put this in a way that I don't have to bend over here. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm going to be talking about. How come it doesn't want to go there? No. I'm going to be talking about two general things, and we'll see how much I can get through. I have 12 pages of script. What I want to do is talk a little bit about professional development activities here in our wonderful state of California that educates about a third of all English language learners are here in the state of California. And then I want to share with you, and I don't know if I can go through this in a great detail, a report that I collaborated with Antonia Lopez from the National Council of La Raza that was funded by the Alliance for Better Communities, funded by Los Angeles First Five, to develop a set of competencies for teachers who work with dual language learners. And so I want to share that with you as well. We have a couple of advisors from that activity here today. We have Renata. Renata's still here, and I don't know if Michelle is here. I saw her earlier. Oh, no, she's not here. So that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm also going to show you a video. I want to share a very interesting video with you of a Korean-speaking child that illustrates the stages of second language acquisition that Karen talked to you about. Okay, so I'll go over some of the points in my presentation that may somewhat overlap with what Karen came up with. But one of the points that Karen made, which I often try to make, is that the term dual language learner is a more accurate term to describe this child population, because it does not dismiss their primary language. The term English language learner really connotes movement to English as soon as possible. And I'm very aware of this because California is an English-only state. Many of our states in the United States are English-only states. And their goal is to move children over to English ASAP. So this is where you get into some contradiction between what research might be telling you is in the best interest of the child in terms of their language development and what social policy or state policy is telling you you have to do as a teacher. In California, we have 65 languages are tabulated for the K-12, and Spanish being the most prominent, followed by Vietnamese or Tagalog, and they kind of go back and forth. But one of the things that you need to recognize is when you're preparing early childhood educators, even if they're bilingual and bicultural, especially in the state of California, the probability of them having to work with children whose language and culture they are unfamiliar with is very great and very high. So we have to be cognizant of that in our teacher preparation. This just illustrates that 36% as of 2012 of incoming kindergarten children in the state of California are identified as English language learners. Now, it's really hard to get a handle on the 0 to 5 population with respect to dual language, because unless the children are in state-funded programs, nobody keeps track of them. But there was a report that was put out by UCLA from a health survey that suggests that 57% of all 0 to 5 children in the state of California come from a home where English is not the primary language. 57%. So this is a huge issue. We have, for the last decade, the United States has experienced a demographic tsunami, where you have particularly Spanish-speaking populations in places in the United States where they never went, because in the old days it was all concentrated in the Southwest, California, Texas, Colorado. But one of the fastest growing rates of Latino population is in the Southeast, is in states like Georgia, North Carolina, that are experiencing tremendous waves of immigration. So when I first started working in bilingual education a long, long time ago, I would go to the East Coast and people didn't even know what, you know, Mexican-Americans were. And now you go to New York City and Queens, the borough of Queens, has this huge Mexican population. So we have seen tremendous demographic changes. And what we also know that when we look at teachers out in the workforce, and I know Marcy Whitebrook is presenting here at the conference, and when we were doing our report, we really tried to find more current data on the workforce in the state of California. And we went to a RAND report, and the latest was about 10 years ago, that suggested that we have about 130,000 individuals working in early care and education. But in Marcy's report, one of the things that she points out way back when was this really lack of preparation of teachers to work with culturally and linguistically diverse populations. And that was a decade ago. This has been confirmed by the Erickson report that came out a number of years ago, and this continues to be a theme that comes out over and over, that we're just not preparing teachers to work with dual language learners. And the teachers themselves feel like they're not prepared to deal with this population. Now, let me just share with you some of the things that are going on in the state of California. In this, you know, we're all, you know, trying to do the early learning challenge grants and all that jazz. And in order to, and for Race to the Top, and in order to qualify, every state has to have certain pieces in place. Chief among them is competencies for teachers. But in the state of California, at the heart of our system are the learning and development foundations. And that's what is often called standards in other parts of the country, right? Pre-K standards. We all have them in different parts of the country. The state of California was the first one to develop specific preschool foundations for English language learners. No one in the nation had ever done that before. And so you can get online and you can see all of these products. We also have a curriculum framework that accompanies the foundations that has a chapter on English language learners. We also have our assessment tool has some items to measure, four items actually, to measure English language. And we also have in revision, we have the program, program guidelines are being revised right now and Linda Espinosa is leading that effort. And then the professional development, the purple box at the corner, that has teacher competencies. So the state of California did come out with a set of teacher competencies. They're like huge, they're really, really detailed. And within those competencies, there's a section on dual language, and there's a section on culture diversity and equity. All of these are downloadable. All of these products are downloadable. If you go to the Child Development Division of the State Department of Education of California, you can download all of this stuff. And in the teacher competencies, they were developed, they have 12 competency areas. Two of which are the dual language and the culture and diversity. They also have areas on observation and screening and also on special needs. So there's a real range. And the way that they developed the competencies was to try to focus on individuals who were in a supporting role, i.e. the assistant teacher, individuals who were in the directing role or in the maintaining role, and that would be the lead teacher, and then they would have program directors as another context, and then people that were advancing the profession like education specialists or faculty in higher education. We also have a faculty initiative project where the State Department is trying to get faculty to utilize all of these publications in their course-bearing classes, ha ha ha. It's hard to convince faculty to do anything. I'm being facetious, but it's hard to change. If your student has to go out and use a screening tool, it would sure be nice to have some practice using that screening tool in a class. If the teacher has to go out and use the foundations, it sure would be nice if they had some exposure to it prior to going out into the field. So really, that's the point. And then finally, the state of California has the California Preschool Instructional Network. We call it CPIN. And CPIN actually will provide professional development, sometimes free of charge. It depends on what's going on. All of these resources, and the CPIN website actually has a lot of good resources on DLL, so you can get on there and see what they have. So that's another resource for you. And then I just want to end my little blurb about what's going on in the state of California with a shout out to a new project that many of you might be interested in, which is called the California Best Practices for Young Dual Language Learners Project, where we have the State Department of Education commissioned six papers about dual language learners that range from focus on brain development to special needs. And they're being written, or they have been written, they're in the last stages of publication. They should be out. They will be posted on the website. And they were commissioned by experts from all over the country. And they're written with an eye towards making recommendations for practice. So we were hoping those papers would be ready by June, but we're a little slow. The other thing is that there will be an accompanying set of video material to this project, and that will be available online so that you can access it. If you have Wi-Fi, you'll be able to access actual examples of teachers interacting with children, dual language learner children. Okay. So those are some resources for you to look at in your free time. Right? Okay, so I already mentioned this report that is downloadable. You have the link there. All you have to do is Google dual language learner teacher competencies and you'll get a PDF. And we were developing these competencies when the State Department was finishing their competencies. These competencies are very specific. They focus on the teacher only in the classroom with 3 and 4 year old children. And what they do is they try to look at the teacher's background characteristics and their level of experience working with dual language learners, so that they're broken down by whether the teacher is monolingual, monocultural, bilingual, biliterate, by whether they're just started working with dual language learners, whether they have more experience, or whether they're advanced. So, and that's the report that I will get into in a bit. Now, we already talked about this issue, which is, how do children become bilingual? How does an individual, how does a person become bilingual? Well, there's different paths to becoming bilingual. And this framework or these ideas actually come from K through 12. When we were first working on English language development foundations, frankly, there was not a lot of research in this area. So we really did have to turn to the K through 12 literature to see how they thought about it. And this actually comes from more the K through 12. But a child who is being exposed to two or more languages is hearing both languages simultaneously can go down the simultaneous path. And my argument has always been that young children tend to be more simultaneous than they are sequential. Because if they have older siblings who are school age, guess what happens? They come home speaking English. And there is research to suggest that young children, dual language learners who have older school age children, will learn English faster. Okay. Then you have the more traditional case that people thought about when they were first thinking about this with older children is a sequential bilingual. And that is a child who is hearing their primary language for anywhere between 3 to 4 or 5 years before they enter formal school. And it is when they go to school that they first encounter a second language. And that is known as a sequential. And then finally, you have receptive bilinguals. And some of you are, how many of you understand a language but can't speak it? You are a receptive bilingual. So basically, that's what I am. I'm more of a receptive bilingual. My mother would speak to me in Spanish. I would speak to her in English. This is common. My older sibs spoke English to me, and I only had to use Spanish when I had to, and I did have to on occasion. So my production isn't as great as my comprehension, and there are a lot of people like me in this world. So those are the routes. Now, Karen already talked to you about this. This is the stages of second language acquisition, which we're going to, I'm going to show you a video of a child going through these stages. Now, some of you got a handout that Sally was passing out earlier, where I want you to kind of pay attention to these stages as you watch the video. But basically, just to reiterate what Karen said, the first stage is a child comes into the preschool setting and they only know their primary language. And so they try to use it, figure out it's not working, it's not meeting their needs, and then shuts up. Figuring this isn't working. And then they become observant. And this comes a lot from the Pat and Tabor's book, One Child, Two Languages, if you're familiar with that text. And Patton actually called it, I think she changed it in the second edition, she originally called it the silent period, which is the second stage. Well, it's not that they're silent. They're watching, they're observing, they're checking things out. So they're active. And then that's followed by telegraphic or formulaic speech, where they use more high-function phrases like wanted, gimme, things like that, where they'll pick up key phrases in English. And then finally, fluid and productive. Now, one of the things when we were working on the foundations here in the state of California, I would argue with the State Department people and the other consultants, was how can you expect a child coming into a one-year, half-day preschool, coming in not knowing English, and 9 months later come out at the other end fluent and productive? It's not realistic when, in fact, it takes a monolingual child to become productive anywhere between 5 to 7 years. And you're expecting this of a second language learner. So sometimes we really do have very unrealistic expectations that we place on a dual language learner. Okay, so now we're going to get to this really interesting video. I hope you find this as interesting as I find it. This is Soyul and her teacher Yvette. And Sally, I wasn't sure if it was an I or a Y. I kept changing it last night. And it's an adventure in preschool second language acquisition. Now, Soyul is a Korean speaker, and she enters preschool at 2 years, 10 months. And she doesn't speak any English, so you're going to see that. And you really have to listen, because she sometimes wants to hide from the camera, and she's quiet. As you watch this 16-minute video, note the stages of what's going on in these stages that we just went through. And this is a video production by Teaching at the Beginning. And Sally Durbin is here, and she has kindly, generously let us see this video. And we're hoping that someday this video is going to find the light of day so that you can use it. All right, so this is where things get crazy. So let's see, I have to go to the video.
Do you have ears? Yeah? They come in all shapes and sizes. This dog has floppy ears, animal noises. What's this thing? That's right, Taylor. Thank you. Oh, look at this one. Bird. Bird says, tweet, 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 tweet. Cat. Cat says, what does cat say to you? Cat says, ruff, ruff. Or meow. Cat says, meow. Do you need help? Help. Good idea. Move your legs up.
Should we watch the show?
Are you having a show over there? Are you feeling my finger? Can I feel? Over here. Can I feel your finger? Your thumb? My thumb? Do we sing a song? Where is thumb? In where is thumb? Is here I am. Here I am. How are you together? There's every little thing you run away. Run away. What's next, ready? Where is Ringman? Here I am. There it is.
Here I am.
How are you today? I'm very well, I think. Oh, there he is. Help? Underneath. Can you see me underneath? There you go. Run away. Run away. What's that? Pinky? Pinky? Can you say Pinky? No? Oh, how? Okay. Say it louder. Ready? I'm gonna go like this. So look at my finger. Good. Oh, you got it. Go ahead, hold it up. Yeah. How are you today? Here and started going to school, like preschool, and my teacher didn't know Spanish, and my first language was Spanish, and all she spoke was English. I had an older sister who spoke English, so I kind of understood, but I was so shy that I was just like, I don't know how to speak in English properly, and I think that's what Soyo felt, like, she didn't feel comfortable, am I saying it right, kind of like me learning Korean for her, like, am I saying it right? She wasn't sure if she was saying it right, so she was often very reserved, shy, constantly touching my fingers, but I would just make her feel more comfortable by giving her the word, like, oh, my nail, you like my nail? She would nod yes. I said, you do like my nail, and kind of reassure that, yes, I understand you. Because I felt like if I give her a little bit, she'll be able to say, yes, you understand. She'll be able to give me more and more, and that's what's kind of built the relationship.
Thank you. Different.
And a lot of friends think it's different.
It's here.
Here. There's a spider.
Spider house.
Oh, it's a spider house. You know what a spider house is called? It's called a spider
web.
Spider makes a home. He uses a thread and he makes a web. Where is the spider?
I know it's people.
Is it somewhere in the pot or in the spider?
No, inside here.
Inside there?
Mm-hmm. What's here?
Who is it?
Where's spider?
I don't know. It could be any spider.
Children, what do you see? I see a brown bear and red bear and yellow duck and blue horse and green frog and purple cat and white duck and brown sheep and yellow fish and teacher.
Hey, good job. You have a whole book to me. I briefly let the parents know when I see a milestone in her language, and she, phrases, I'll tell the parents, this is what she said today, and they're amazed. They're like, she speaks English? I said, yes, at school. And they're like, she doesn't speak English at home. I said, that's because you have Korean at home, and she should keep that. But at school, she's able to call her friend over and say, I don't like it when you something else, or stop, you're hurting me. She's able to address those feelings. And that was their reservation, was how is she going to express herself? How is she going to tell her children, I don't like it? And I said, she has that now. She's developed that, and they were just impressed and utterly grateful. They were like, wow. And then they asked her in English, and she'll respond in Korean, because she knows mom and dad don't speak English. They may ask, but I'm going to respond to them in Korean.
Remember, I'm trying to learn how to count it in Korean. Can you help me slowly? How do you say this? Hana?
Two.
Ne.
Ne. Hana. Yosa. Ibu. Yosa. Amo. Tumu. Tumam. Tumu. Two.
Oh, what's the last one?
Tumu. Two.
Tumu. Two. Can you tell me what we're for studying?
Ballet.
What's ballet?
It's a kind of movement.
It's a kind of movement. So can you tell me something else you learned in ballet?
Put your leg up this way.
And why do you need to put your leg up this way?
And back way.
And the back way. So one leg goes forward and one goes...
Yeah, my mommy helped me and my
daddy
helped me.
Really?
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah.
So that's why your mom and dad needed to help you?
Yeah.
Are you practicing at home? Huh? Do you have any special things you wear for ballet? What do you wear for ballet?
Ballet clothes.
What does it look like?
Pink.
It's pink. Yeah,
pink dragon.
And pink treasures too.
And then pink flowers.
Pink flowers. What else do you wear for ballet?
And nothing. And then ballet shoes.
Ballet shoes. Why do you need special shoes for ballet?
Ballet shoes.
Why do you need ballet shoes?
Because you have studs.
You have studs. Yeah.
Okay, so there you saw a case of a child going through the stages of second language acquisition. So what did you see at the very beginning in stage one, where she's trying to use her home language? And what did the teacher do to help her? It was repetition of she was repeating the word in Korean. She was trying to repeat the word in Korean. What else did you notice about Soyul? Pardon?
She
Pardon me? She's, well, in the very beginning stage, what did you notice about her? Was she persistent and articulate in the beginning? She tried. She thought that he understood Korean. But you notice a strategy that the teacher used. The teacher was, and also I hope you noticed the affective tone of Soyul in the very beginning. She was kind of reticent, right? She was not saying that much in Korean. Her body language was very withdrawn, you know, she was kind of pulled in. Then she moved to the quiet observant stage. What did you notice there?
She listened and nodded.
When she was reading the book with the teacher, there was a lot of just nodding her head and trying to take in all that information, just like Patricia Kuhl talked about in terms of trying to take in the statistics. You have the second language learner trying to take in the information. What did you notice that the teacher was doing? A lot of body language. And the issue with the quiet period is that the child is learning during the quiet period. Just because they're quiet doesn't mean they're not learning something. And so we shouldn't be neglecting them during that period. But she was doing a lot of nodding, but she wasn't verbalizing very much. Okay. But the teacher continued to provide her with language. And then in the third stage, which was when she starts to use telegraphic and formulaic, what did you notice about her at that point? What was she doing? What did you notice about the way
her... Well, she was smiling.
She was, her body language was qualitatively different. She, I don't know, did you feel like she seemed more confident to you?
Yeah.
Renata? Well, it's almost like when a toddler learns how to, or when a one-year-old learns how to walk, it's like, oh my God, I get to do this. So what you saw there was Sayul using what Tabor's calls high-function words. She didn't have a lot of vocabulary, but she has a few kind of formulaic things that she was saying. I'm making a plane, I'm making a, and then just sticking in different vocabulary words. What you also noticed, what was the teacher doing when Soyul wanted to play in the sandbox? She facilitated finding another child to play with her. You notice that initially the other child, well, there was another child said, nah, I don't want to do this. And she found somebody to work with Soyul. One of the issues with dual language learners is they will learn more language from their peers than they will oftentimes from the teachers. And teachers must make a concerted effort to pair them with their friend with friends so that they can practice, because that's where they're going to get their practice. And so you saw them engage, you saw her engage in a more formulaic speech at that point. And then when she was on the teeter-totter, what was she doing? Singing, was it Itsy Bitsy Spider? One of the things, I don't know if you've noticed, and we see it, there's some other video clips that it's going to come with a series, is the use of rhyme and finger plays and sing songs for dual language learners and how they really latch onto that in terms of starting to feel in control. You saw how hard she really concentrated on where is Thumbkin. She really, really wanted to figure that out, and she spent time. So what you see is that the use of rhymes, the use of songs, really facilitates them starting to practice the language. And you saw that with Soyul. And then at the end, what did you see? In the productive, more fluid period, when she was talking about ballet. She understood what was being asked of her, and she could respond. Now, you could see that she was saying, like, stop asking me all these open-ended questions. Like, come on. But the point was to see what she understood, and she did understand what was being asked of her. and she was better at expressing herself. Now, it wasn't whole sentences and whole phrases, and it wasn't as fluid, but this was the beginning of that stage. Okay, so I wanted to show you this because we talk about these stages, but often you need to see them to know what they look like. And you need to, one of the issues is, sure, we know about these stages of second language acquisition, but what is the pedagogical practice that should be associated with a particular stage? Often we neglect to think about that. We go, oh yeah, they go through these stages, but trying to get teachers to recognize these stages and figure out what should I be doing with a child during a particular stage of development is really a key. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay, then I'm gonna go back to my PowerPoint and get into it.
How much time do I have?
20 minutes. Okay, all right, so I want to get into the dual language competencies, teacher competencies, and what we did in this particular project. This was hard to do. What we were funded was to develop teacher competencies for dual language learners, and when we got into it, we thought, oh, this is going to be that hard, ha, ha, ha. And we brought in a panel of national experts, and I'll show you their names right now, and to develop a report to focus on competencies for early childhood educators and to meet those needs. The consultants are myself. You can see how good I look when I'm Photoshopped. Antonia Lopez from the National Council of La Raza and David Atencio from the University of New Mexico. We will be presenting this report in more detail tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock if you're interested. Now, these are our advisors. They came from all the different, they came from all over the U.S. It was heavy on California. And it was spectacular meetings that we had with our advisors. To try to really address the needs of dual language learners and thinking about what do teachers need to know and be able to do to work with dual language learners. And in general, we came up with this conceptual model that at the base of any set of competencies or anything one wants to do in the educational field, we have to really be explicit about our values. We have to be clear of what our underlying set of assumptions are. Because often, they're, especially when it comes to dual language learners, they're not clear in state policy, et cetera. So we spent one whole day over at some airport by hotel by the airport formulating a set of core competencies to underlie working with dual language learners. And then that's followed by dispositions. We talked about dispositions as being foundational to teacher competencies, the values, the attitudes, the beliefs of the teachers themselves, that we needed to really talk about that. Because when you look at teacher competencies in the literature, it's basically knowledge, skills, and dispositions. We call them the, you know, or sometimes they're called KSAs, knowledge, skills, and abilities. But if you look at the literature, that's what, the way that it's broken down. And then finally, we focused on teacher competencies. So just very quickly, because I don't have that much time to go into a lot of detail, one of the, and some of this will resonate with some of the comments that Karen made, was that dual language learner children have a right to a high quality education that is culturally and linguistically appropriate to them. They should, are entitled to that. And we know that when they do have it, it will optimize their development. We also felt that knowing more than one language has a lot of cognitive, as in the brain development, social benefits and emotional benefits. people that are bilingual are more tolerant of diversity. People that are bilingual can access populations of people and communicate with them in a language that a monolingual person may not be able to do. So there are clear advantages to being bilingual in the social, cognitive, social, and emotional domains. Now, one of the areas that a lot of linguists look at is this issue of transference that Karen alluded to. First language, the development of a child's first language is critical to the development of their second language. Let me repeat that. The development of their first language is critical to their development of their second language. This is a really tough issue for us in early childhood education. Because what happens is often the children will switch over to English very quickly and lose their home language. And there's somewhat of a literature base, not so much in early childhood, but in adolescence, that talks about the psychological effects of language loss on children and their inability to communicate with their grandparents, their inability to understand their culture very well, their sense of ethnic identity. So the issue of first language development, what we want to do is be able to really, not just as when I first started working in with the State Department, quote unquote, honor the home language, because I wasn't sure what honor the home language meant, but really talk about how can we use the home language to help the child learn. Now, it really depends on your state policy and your own point of view about whether the goal is to move them over into English right away, or if the goal is to preserve the home language over the long run. Two different issues. But the science is clear that there is transference between one language and another. And that's why the vocabulary needs to be measured in both languages. So the child may know a concept in their home language, but they don't know the label for it in English. And so often when I'm working with parents, that's what I often will tell them. You know, just speak to your child as much as you can in the home language, because that will help them with their English development. Just talk to them, and they will then understand the concept of red or ball or square or whatever, and then they'll just learn the new word for it in English. Now, this is huge. The issue of socio-emotional development. Think of Soyul. Think of how she was when she started. Think of how the teacher facilitated her through the social relationship that the teacher had with the child, how she helped her. Dual language learners will function, all children will function better if the teacher-child relationship is a positive one. We know that. But if the teacher doesn't understand the language of the child and just tells the assistant teacher, well, you go deal with those kids over there, children are sensitive to that. They figure that out. So, and I'll get back to socio-emotional development if I have time. And then and then family engagement is, you know, as early childhood educators, we are very close to the families. When families drop their children off with us, they are leaving their children. We become substitute parents for those children when they're with us. And they, you know, feel bad about leaving their kids. They're nervous about leaving their children with a teacher who doesn't speak the home language. We must make efforts to connect with families when we're working with dual language learners to find out more about the families themselves, to get the families to feel comfortable with us, to find out more things about the child from their home culture. because we, and to try to the extent possible to get parents involved in supporting their children. I mean, the research evidence is very clear that parental involvement equates to better school performance. And one of the things that I think was also an issue that underlied what Karen was talking about is, and we talk about it in the social sciences, we've been talking about it since I was in graduate school many years ago, the movement from a deficit perspective of minority children and linguistic minority children to a strength-based approach, where we value their home language, where we don't think because they don't speak English, they don't know anything. And you hear people say things like that. Oh, well, they don't know any language. Because they don't recognize or value what the children are coming with. The children do have a language. They do know about how to interact around language, but it may be different, okay? And then this is something that our advisors really wanted to stick in to the core principles, because what often happens is that a teacher may be interested in supporting dual language learners in the classroom, but there is no support for them in their programs. And I have been in programs that really don't provide in-service for teachers, don't provide time off for teachers to go off and learn about dual language learners, don't provide planning time, that's a big issue, to really focus on the needs. So, but we know that reflective practice for all teachers is a key to improvement. Okay, now, a minute. Okay. Let me just go through this and I just might shoot over. Let me put all of this and we'll talk about this more tomorrow morning. We also have a set of dispositions that we think are critical for teachers who work with dual language learners. And I'm going to go from bottom to top very quickly. The second bullet from the bottom. One of the things that dual language teachers have to be able to figure out is how to deal with contradiction and ambiguity and be resilient in the face of it. Because working in this field is tough, is complicated. It's not for the faint of heart. Because your heart might be telling you to do something and your director is telling you to do something else. Or what the question I get when from directors is, oh, Marlene, our teachers are bilingual, but they're going to English-only kindergarten. What do we do? Our parents are coming back and telling us we didn't prepare them for kindergarten. What do we do? I mean, these are the ethical dilemmas that you face in this field. And one of the things that I think Karen alluded to with her focus on poverty is that many of these children are coming from very poor backgrounds. They're coming from communities that are not very organized. They're coming from difficult life circumstances. And that complicates learning in general. And so that's one of the dispositions that we talk about that I think is more unique, is develop and sustain a consciousness. Have a commitment and maintain that commitment to cultural responsivity. Okay, very quickly, when we're dealing with teachers, one size does not fit all. And so what happens in many of these strategies and books, even, you know, and I'm guilty of the same thing, is we'll give you a laundry list of generic pedagogical strategies, right? Learn how to pronounce a child's name, sing the good morning song in various languages. But it's more than that. And it really depends on the teacher, on their dispositions and their qualifications. So in the teacher competencies for dual language learners, and that we disaggregated it by whether a teacher was monolingual, whether the teacher was bilingual, or whether the teacher was biliterate. Because different teachers have different skill sets. And one of the points I want to make before more people leave the room is that because even if you're monolingual, monocultural, you can be effective with DLLs. You are not off the hook. Because I hear teacher educators will say that their students come back to them and report, well, they don't speak English, so I don't know what to do with them. So what we did is we began to disaggregate it by, in a sense, a person's acculturation level and their language ability. So this is the format for language and literacy. Monolingual, bilingual, biliterate. Cultural competency, whether you're monocultural or bicultural, and it depends on the child. If I was working with Soyul, I'd be monolingual, monocultural. But if I'm working with a Spanish-speaking child, I would be more bilingual, bicultural. Okay, so it depends. And then also, whether you're a beginning teacher versus whether you're an advanced teacher. How much experience do you have working with DLLs? It'll be different for somebody that's just starting off versus somebody that has more experience. And so this is what the matrix looks like. And so that's why I said it was really hard. You had to fill in all of those. Now, what this means is as you move on the horizontal from the left to right, the bilingual teacher should be able to do everything the monocultural, the monolingual teacher can do. And the biliterate individual should be able to do everything that everybody to the left does. It's cumulative. It moves in that direction. Similarly, it moves downward. The advanced teacher at the bottom should be able to do everything that the developing and the beginning teacher does. Okay? So that's the way that we constructed it. Originally, we had 5 domains. We were very ambitious. And we couldn't do it because we didn't have the time or the resources, and we landed up focusing just on language and literacy and socio-emotional development. And so we have 3 components for language and literacy. The first one has to do with both first and second language acquisition. One of the things that happens when we go out to the field is that many teachers, and in the state of California for a long time, teachers did not have a course on second language acquisition. They barely had a course on language development. So you'd go out to do training and they didn't even know basic language development. So we need to think about how we're gonna focus that in our teacher preparation and how language and culture relates to it. We also need to focus on literacy development. So it's not just language development, but it's in literacy development, print and reading skills. Demonstrates knowledge of the cognitive and social benefits of bilingualism and biculturalism. So we talked about that, I think, already in some of Karen's comments. Now, why competencies in socio-emotional development? Why? Because teachers who, there's this famous study that we're citing left, right, and center because there's been very little work on it, done by Chang based on the multi-state study, found that teachers who spoke the home language of the preschool children, and in this particular case it was Spanish, rated the children more positively. And the ones that didn't speak the language of the child tended to rate the child more negatively and perceive them as having more behavioral problems. You know, and it makes sense. Think about it. If the child comes into your preschool classroom and doesn't understand the directions that you're giving them or the routines, they're going to be roaming around the classroom. They're going to be possibly acting out. They don't know what's going on. And so as a consequence, they often will get rated negatively. And the problem with that is that the study also found a peer influence. When the teacher was positive towards a dual language learner, The peer was positive towards the dual language learner. Big surprise. Okay, I'm running out of time. I have 3 minutes. All right, so let me just quickly go through the socio-emotional and I'll stop. The socio-emotional development is influenced by the child's first language and second language and culture, the importance of the teacher-child relationship, understanding the phases of second language acquisition, and understanding the importance of parent-teacher. So I'm going to stop there. Okay. You can download the report. If you're interested in more information, you can come to our workshop tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. And David's going to be talking at that point. All right, thank you.